coming to you from my apartment that doubles as a podcast recording studio. This is What Should I Do With My Life with Steph Horowitz. I'm Steph Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. This podcast is about how none of us know what we're doing. None of us have it figured out. No matter if you seem like you have it all together, you really don't, so be honest. We're going to talk about real stories from real people, their experiences, how they're figuring it out. From career pivots to being in the same industry for 40 years, we're going to hash this thing out so we can all find more meaning and passion in our work and day-to-days. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show. Today, we got my brother, Dr. Adam Horowitz, on the pod. Adam is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Medicine in their psychiatry department. Go blue. His psychology career has combined many different elements, from research to clinical work and therapy with patients, teaching and lecturing, and so much more. Some of his areas of interest and focus include cognitive and behavioral risk factors associated with suicidal behavior, trauma-focused therapy with veterans, and CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy for mood and anxiety disorders. I do want to give a trigger warning. We do touch a bit on subjects he works in, which is, you know, deals with suicide and trauma. So please keep that in mind. In this episode, Adam shares with us a bit about how he compartmentalizes the difficult subject matter he deals with in his work. He tells us how he overcame his own imposter syndrome when starting off in his career and how we can do the same, and also tells us how we can use values as opposed to goals to help us navigate our careers. Do therapists go to therapy? Do therapists go to therapy? Are we all throwing around the terms "I'm depressed" or "I have trauma" a bit too loosely? And if so, what's the impact? Can Adam turn off his psychologist lens when he's in a social setting and just living his day-to-day life? You better find out and listen. A special shout out to the box of Kiwis that propped up our microphone so nicely through the episode. I am so proud of my brother and the important work he does. He's made major contributions in his research, in his work with patients, and where he finds the most impact in his work. Just might surprise you like it surprised me. So here is my amazing brother, Dr. Adam Horowitz.
Meh.
You're not nervous?
No.
Why? Why not?
Should I be?
You're a guest on your number one podcast of all time, so I think you should be a little nervous, no?
I've been preparing for this my whole life.
You've been waiting for this day your whole life. Well, it's a good thing that we're recording, and it's a good thing that the microphone is balancing on this box of Kiwis we have right over here, because...
Golden Kiwis.
Gold. What does that even mean?
It's yellow on the inside.
Oh, that's special. Well, hopefully we won't bruise any Kiwis on the way. But we are officially recording. This is officially happening, and you're officially being interviewed for your most favorite podcast of all time. My number one fan. What Should I Do With My Life's number one fan, my brother, Adam Horowitz. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Happy to be here.
That's an understatement. How do you really feel? Aside from that, you've been waiting your whole life for this.
Ecstatic.
Ecstatic. You could hear it in his voice, everybody. Slowly but surely, we're moving through the fam, and you're getting to know everybody. And Adam is one of my two older brothers, and he is my number one fan and has been very supportive of the pod from the beginning, and he always listens to the episodes within how long?
Usually within the first day.
That's a true fan. Thank you, Adam. So, true to form, Adam Gabriel Horowitz, Dr. Horowitz, I should say, in one sentence, what do you do?
Yeah, so you always ask this question of people, and I long would say that it's a struggle to answer it, because often when I do see people and they ask from a title standpoint, I'd say assistant professor, and they say, what do you teach? And I say, I don't teach. Or I might say, I'm a clinical psychologist, and say, oh, like, tell me about your practice. And I say, well, I only have a small caseload. But I am an academic psychologist in a psychiatry department at the University of Michigan, predominantly doing research. But also clinical work and some supervision of clinical trainees.
So many hats, many different types of work. And it's funny that you said you get a little, you didn't say the word overwhelmed, but that you don't really know how to answer that question because of how you just said. And I think a lot of people don't like answering that question. I know I don't like answering that question, yet on the podcast I ask it to everyone, something I could possibly reevaluate. But I want to take it back a notch because our Baba Sally used to say, like, she would say, like, Dan, my older brother, Dan, and she would kind of be swatting with her hands. Adam, straight focus. She would do this, like, straight focus thing with her hands. I feel like I'm more of the swatting, but you've been for a very long time on this very focused path in clinical psychology, but I know that you thought you had a different path in mind, maybe in college. So were you supposed to be pre-med? Were you on the pre-med track? Why? How did things change? What happened there?
Yeah, so when I started undergrad, I did kind of take some of those prereq types of classes, chemistry, biology, things like that. And a large group of my friends at the time were all pre-med, and they did all go on to do medical school and various doctors and things like that. So I think I was just doing what everyone else was doing before knowing what I wanted to do. I think one of those wake-up calls was, I think my second semester, my first biology test, I believe I got like a 52% or something like that, which was not at like the bottom of that class and of that curve. They said they'd eventually curve it, but actually they don't. They just have people who drop out over time and it worked its way up. So I stuck with it, and over the course of that semester actually finished the overall class with a B minus, and I needed like an A on that final exam, and I think I had the highest score on my section. I had studied like harder for that than anything else. So like I'm more proud of that B minus than probably most other grades. But at the same time, after having gone through that, I was like, okay, and now I know that I don't want to do this. That like it taught me the study skills that I definitely applied and were very valuable for everything else moving forward, because I never really studied a lot in school. I kind of, you know, did my work, what was necessary, got my, you know, B's and A's, things like that. Was never like that I need to get straight A's type of thing. But after that, I was like, okay, like now I can take what I've learned from this experience and apply it in these areas. And the psychology classes that I was taking were just much more interesting, fascinating, triggered different ideas. And I started getting involved with research and different research labs. I think that summer after freshman year and moved through a few of those before eventually landing in the lab where I would stay and continue doing my graduate work and continue to do some work with even now.
You, like I said, you just had this plan, and it's been a very long it's been a long road education wise. And also, of course, as you continue with your research and whatever, but a few things coming to mind. First of all, why did you even think you wanted to do pre-med? Let's start with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think at a basic level, I had an interest in doing something that was, you know, going to be helpful for other people, I think, as a core piece. Like, I wasn't necessarily driven by the business side of things or law kinds of stuff. You know, it was something that I could see myself being interested in. And then once it came to it, you know, finding with the classes, at least, right, like it gets very granular between chemistry and biology and the cellular levels and all these different things. And through the different psychology classes that I was taking, found myself very interested in just the social dynamics and, you know, just all those interactive things between people and groups and conformity and all those different things you learn about during those introductory psychology courses. That was much more fascinating to me, and I was more motivated to learn the ins and outs of those kinds of things.
Did you feel like, and you know, Sherry was in the School of Education and she knew she wanted to be a teacher, and obviously it varies by person and school or university, but some people are going to school just to get a degree and then they pursue a career in something totally different. You know, I know plenty of people who studied psychology undergraduate and they are not psychologists or therapists or researchers in the field. So I guess I'm wondering if it was immediate that I'm studying psychology and I want to be a psychologist, or like, was it just was there an aha moment, or was it clear that was going to be the career path as opposed to a liberal arts and sciences degree and then you'll figure it out later on what you do professionally?
Yeah, it's a good question. Honestly, if you went back and asked me during those different phases, I'm not positive what my answer would have been. I think it was just one of those things where whatever I was doing at the time and was enjoying it and felt I was good at it and had that sense of, yeah, competence in that area, that I just kept going. And, you know, like the research piece and investigating and experimentation. And, you know, one of the things too, I would say with psychology that I always liked or stood out to me, is that you could learn something in one of those lectures, in one of those classes, and then like step out of the classroom and start to see it in action just on campus between different people, different concepts, even things that I might be doing, cognitive biases, right? Whatever it may be. And I really latched on to that sense of like seeing that in action all the time. And yeah, in terms of grad school, it was probably maybe around junior or senior year where I was like, okay, like it just seemed like that was the natural progression of what other people in those programs were doing. And so applied. I had a gap year between grad school where I would just worked a year doing research as a lab manager. But yeah, I don't know if there was ever, you know, if you had asked me my junior year or something like that, if it was like, I want to be a clinical psychologist. And I probably at that time didn't know if I wanted to do clinical work versus research or what combination. I think it was just continuing to see what experiences and opportunities came up and just following it without necessarily looking too far down the road, but just taking things a couple years at a time and seeing how it went. And obviously with the PhD, knowing that was a 5-year commitment. But yeah, from that point in time, even going into it, I didn't know if I wanted to be an academic, you know, teaching at a university versus being in a medical school like I am now, or at a VA, or, you know, something else all together.
But it sounded like you knew that you would need a PhD in order to pursue any of those paths you just shared. So what was your mindset like at the time? When I think about a PhD, I think, oh my God, you just said 5 years. It's a really long time. It's a big commitment. You should be pretty certain about what you're doing. You know, you're not going to put in 5 years of school and then, oh, actually, I want to be a swim instructor like your son. Maybe you will. Obviously, you know, people do the shifts all the time and we support the pivots. But were you like, yeah, 5 years of school? Were you dreading it? Were you excited about it? Were you neutral toward it? I mean, it takes some persistence to put your head down and do that. And you did way more than just those 5 years too.
Yeah. No, again, at that time, I don't think I was too wrapped up in like, this is 5 years of my life. This was just, this is what's coming next. And in each year in the type of program, I mean, one of the nice things, it's not the first year or two, there's classes, but after those first 2 years, you're not even really taking classes anymore, but you're doing teaching as a graduate student instructor, you're doing clinical work, you're doing your own research projects and things like that. So it's not like classroom learning for the duration of that period. It's very experiential and doing different things. And so yeah, so those things, again, I found interesting and enjoyable at the time. And one of the things with clinical psychology that I knew going into it, because at one point I was thinking about, I also like social psychology, developmental psychology, some of these different areas that I could have potentially gone down that road. And I knew that with the clinical psychology degree that had the most flexibility, because it opened the door to clinical work if you wanted to do clinical work. Whereas if you're a developmental psychologist or social psychologist, it's much more, you know, academic or bust, although now there's obviously industry jobs and things like that folks do from those different fields. But at that time, that was one of the considerations, was some of that flexibility of whether it's teaching versus research versus clinical. You get the training, you get the experience in those different areas. And, you know, and even now, right, like right now it's mostly research and a little clinical, but I can't say 10, 20 years down the line if there's teaching mixed in or other things. I think that's just a really nice thing, is, you know, having multiple avenues that you can go down and allowing whatever opportunities to come up to just coalesce with the areas that you have experience and interest in.
Yeah, it is really nice. Because on the one hand, again, I jokingly say, but seriously say, you know, it's always been the straightforward path and very, very focused. But at the same time, like you're saying now, and as your whole, your studies and your career have been there, it's quite dynamic, you know, because you are mixing different things, speaking in front of, you know, giving lectures and teaching, working with patients one-on-one or in group settings, doing the research, heads down work, you know, it is quite a mix. A few different thoughts and questions. Obviously, I have a ton. Your focus on teen depression and suicide, was that wrapping up the end of your undergrad and then you continued that focus into your PhD? Or was that focus declared in your PhD? And then how did you choose this subject? It's quite intense and heavy. And how come you chose that as a focus for your thesis and work?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that during undergrad, I had started working in a few different labs. My first lab was with, it was like preschoolers, and I was watching these, coding these videotapes of these kids completing puzzles that had like one missing piece or like one substitute piece mixed in. And it was like a frustration task, and I had to do like facial coding and on-task, off-task types of things. Then I did some work in a social lab, and then finally during my junior year I got into that clinical space in terms of thinking that I might want to do clinical psychology, and the lab I was in was the Youth Depression and Suicide Prevention Lab. And I was interested in that group because of, so the age group at that time I was interested in adolescents and younger populations. And even though I wasn't necessarily interested in suicide specifically, there were a lot of the surrounding areas that are risk factors for suicide, like depression, like substance use, things like that, that coalesce. So it was a good space to be able to explore some of those interests, because there's so many different areas that really can ultimately culminate in that. And obviously too, right, like it's a massive problem, you know, nationally and internationally, and affects everybody from every walk of life, you know, young and old, rich or poor, you name it. It's just one of those really challenging issues that unfortunately we haven't been able to solve or make a lot of headway in the research that's been done so far. So I think some of the aspects of A, its importance for obvious reasons, as well as the challenge of it, was something that was something that oriented me towards this area and trying to learn more about what we can do to try to reduce suicide.
For you being like 20 years old or 21 and starting to deep dive into that field sounds very intense. And obviously since then you have been working with very heavy subject matter and working with a lot of folks who've experienced trauma, whether it's veterans or people who have experienced sexual abuse and just various hardships. So how does that affect you, if at all, on a day-to-day? Like sometimes it's hard to switch off your, you have to switch off your brain at the end of the day. Otherwise, I feel like you're absorbing these really hard stories and things you're hearing, and you're developing relationships with patients and people you're working with. And how do you distance yourself from that and not let it affect your mood? Because you're really spending so many, all of your working days dabbling, and not even dabbling, in depth, neck high in these really hard subjects. How do you deal with it?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that is definitely true is that I don't think I'd be able to do it if I was doing clinical work and trauma work full-time, nonstop. I think that's where having different hats, different roles, things like that can really help with some of the balance, is, you know, not just being totally enveloped in that each day, every day, that comes. Overall, I think with respect to some of that compartmentalization, I mean, yeah, it's definitely affects you. I think, I don't know if there's a way to kind of teach or not teach how to just gain that separation, but you know, I think one of the things that I know other therapists have talked about is intentionally not visualizing the things as it's being described, because as a therapist, right, like you have a particular role there, and while empathy is a piece of it, you don't want the empathy to get in the way of kind of the work you're trying to do in that space. So I know that, you know, for me, kind of over time, and you know, you learn to do it as you get better, is right, like if I'm working with someone, they're providing, say, their trauma narrative, my brain is not necessarily focusing in on like the graphic details of what's happening, but I'm listening for very specific target points that will be relevant for the intervention piece when we get to that. So some of it is almost like over time, your brain starts to train for what you're listening for. And it's not necessarily the things that a casual observer who's listening to this, that those are, you know, the same things that pop for them are not necessarily the things that I'm paying most attention to. So as long as I'm kind of viewing it through that lens of, right, what are the kind of the guilt and the shame and the blame points that I want to kind of be focusing in on, that's coming up later, that might not necessarily be the particular details that are coming up. So I think there are different things that over time allow for some of that separation and disconnection while continuing to be present and continuing to be empathetic and all those kinds of things that you can do both in that fashion, but that comes with time and practice.
I'm wondering how many of your peers and colleagues are getting support for their own mental health. I know, I think it was a book and then they made it a show. There's some book I read, I think Mom read it too, about some therapist, and it's about like her therapist and her work she's doing with her therapist. And I'm just wondering how many of these mental health professionals who are also seeking out support for their own mental health.
Yeah, that's a good question. I imagine that it's probably a similar number, if not maybe more, just because there's less stigma or other things around it. But yeah, I mean, everyone has their stuff, their history. And again, right, like I think there's many different areas of psychology and psychotherapy and things that my guess is that for most people, at least, there's probably kind of what they're dealing with, I would hope for most, is not necessarily what they're working with people on, because I think that might be a little bit more tricky.
Too close to home.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like if you're working with folks with substance use and you have some anxiety thing over here or depression over there, right? Like I think that's different than if you're kind of actively working on the same thing that you're working with your clients or patients with. I think that's a little bit more complicated.
For sure. You said something before. I burped.
Yeah, I heard. I had a funny story too from the previous questions that I could work in. But
well, we can. We could do whatever we want. But you said before about the stigma is reduced, and I wanted to bring that up right before you said it, how today people are way more open about their mental health struggles, and the celebrities and the famous people and all the social media platforms are giving everyone the chance to share about their mental health. And I feel like on the one hand, yes, we're taking away the stigma, we're normalizing that people have the mental health, many of us face mental health challenges or depression, anxiety, etc. And on the other hand, there's also a side of it where maybe we're throwing things around too loosely, like, oh, I feel XYZ. Like I've seen myself when I'm looking for answers of why do I feel this way, I'm like, do I have PMDD? Do I have ADHD and it's manifesting this way? Like kind of looking for reasons about why I feel where I feel. And I've seen a lot of people saying, well, everyone's just throwing around that they have anxiety and they have depression and they don't actually, or they don't know what that means, but it's just become so loosely woven into our vocab and, you know, day to day. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely something to that. I think with respect to trauma in particular, like a lot of times people will just describe kind of any negative event as right, trauma or traumatic. And sometimes even within the field, we'll refer to kind of what we call a capital T versus like a lowercase t trauma to try to distinguish those things. Because, right, true trauma would be kind of life-threatening situation, you know, physical, sexual violence, things like that, not, you know, a relationship breakup or loss, you know, right? Like, and again, those things can be traumatic, but in that clinical space, we make that separation. Or I think a common one too would be like OCD, when people describe themselves as OCD because they're very particular or, you know, like things a certain way. But, right. You know, those can diminish the true impact of those things in their full diagnostic form. But to everyone's point, right, like, you know, we have clinical disorders that are kind of given these criteria cutoffs of you either meet this or you don't meet this, but at the same time, they're based on traits that exist on a continuum, right? So, you know, yeah, we all have different degrees of anxiety, and it's a question of whether this anxiety is significantly disrupting your everyday activities, your relationships, your work, things like that, that we consider it a disorder in need of treatment and things like that. So there are definitely those dividing lines, but, you know, and in reality, yes, like we all on this continuum exhibit these different things that may exist. And yeah, at the same time, being aware of how we're using things, especially if we're using the term that is consistent, like OCD, like PTSD, with a formal diagnosis, that's kind of a dividing line. Anxiety itself is not a specific diagnosis, it's a trait. You have generalized anxiety disorder, right. Social anxiety disorder, panic right. disorder, right? Like there's different features of that. So I think that's fine, but not describing it at that criteria level would probably be something to advise.
Do you want to weave in that story you wanted to share before? Is it too water under the bridge?
Sure. So you asked about difficulty with taking things home after experiences. So one thing that...
Sorry, he hit the Kiwi box.
Yeah, Kiwi's right there. So when I was working at the VA during my internship, or this might have even been during clinical practicum, I was hearing these stories of vets who had particularly terrible road rage incidents where they were extremely triggered in traffic and things like that. And my lovely wife, Sherry, bless her heart, is not shy when driving if, you know, someone cuts her off or makes a mistake. Like she feels very comfortable making use of her horn and fingers and whatever else may be necessary.
Showing off her manicure.
Exactly. Demonstrating that accent nail. So yeah, like around that time, like when she started doing that and I was hearing these stories, I had to be, I'm like, no, you can't do that anymore. Like you have no idea who is in this other car next to you. It could be some, you know, pissed off veteran with firearms who's going to get out, see you're driving, then come to me on the passenger side. And it's probably not going to end well for anybody. And since then, I think I've scaled it back, although I think to Sherry's credit too, she is pulled back from those things as well. But I mean, yeah, it's just one of those things where, and, you know, and I know I've worked with folks who, yeah, like have a lot of anxiety about their kids because they're hearing these stories about all these other people and things that are happening. And there's, you know, there's no way not to be affected by it. And so it's important to kind of just zoom back. And so even with like veterans, all I would hear being that I was working in a PTSD clinic in a VA hospital for folks who are struggling, who are having issues and things like that, all I hear are just like these horrible negative experiences about the military. But in reality, like most people go through and have very positive experiences. That's not representative of what's happening just because that's the only side that I'm hearing from. And so I think being able to scale back and just remembering that what I'm hearing from folks is from that population who right. has experienced those bad things doesn't necessarily mean that that's necessarily true for the broader group, regardless of the issue or population or whatever else. So I think that has been helpful too, to separate back when I hear about these traumas or hear about, you know, parents who've had horrible things happen to their children with children of my own, to not get, you know, sucked into those things, or at least having those experiences make it seem like to me that, oh, all these dangers are so much more likely because I'm hearing about them all the time, because it is a select group that I am working with.
That's really interesting. You have to zoom out, take a step back, and you have to, separate yourself a bit. That's really interesting. I guess I wasn't really thinking about it in terms of you hearing horrible things that happen to children and then that happening to your own children. I think it was just being empathetic and kind of absorbing and taking on these horrible things, not necessarily a fear that they'll happen to you or people you love. But that's a whole other layer, obviously. You said that in college, when you started learning, you started kind of applying these techniques and, people always jokingly say, like, are you psychoanalyzing me right now? Like, are you always wearing those glasses? And I guess I would ask you that. Are you psychoanalyzing me right now? I'm just kidding. I mean, whatever. But do you feel... I know, you know me quite well. But do you feel like you can turn that brain on or off? Or is this the lens, how you see the world? And when you interact with friends, family, strangers, you're kind of always doing it through this psychologist lens?
I mean, so I first say that I disagree with just psychoanalysis even of itself is not something that I do. That is a specific form of therapy, which is much more, like you said, inferential, whereas my work is predominantly in cognitive behavior therapy. In terms of interacting with other people, I don't think so. I don't think any more than I've always just tried to figure out people and, what their motivations are and things like that. I will say that, especially with more experience in the trauma realm, that I've definitely noticed that if meeting new people, or I know that there's been meeting another teacher or something like that who shares with that, I can sometimes sense trauma histories with people or the kind of hard things in the past. I don't know if I can truly define it, that I could describe it to somebody else so that someone else could see it too. For the most part, I think just the same types of processes of getting to know people and getting a sense of them. I don't think I have a specific hat that I put on and then take off in that space. And I think a part of that is too, because in general, I think that's one of the nicest things about becoming a therapist and me, kind of my development in those therapy skills was just slowly learning that I didn't have to play a therapist. I could just be myself, right? I think when first doing it, and I had a ton of anxiety when starting both clinical training, also a lot of anxiety when I first started doing teaching. I think just one of the first things that, I started to learn, or the most valuable thing in therapy, was not feeling like I had to say what the therapist is supposed to say, but just be myself, apply the things that I've learned and the strategies and the tools for therapy, but doing it through my own voice as opposed to this pretend voice. And over time that just became fairly singular. So I think that's a big piece of it as well.
I think it's reassuring to hear that you were really nervous and felt anxious before starting these very serious roles. I mean, I think it's just I look at you you're an expert, you're a professional, and we all get nervous and we all start somewhere and you just gotta kind of dive in and do it. And also when you said, when you were nervous about teaching and talking in front of large groups of people, I was thinking, Dan and I, we love being the center of attention in the spotlight. We speaking in front of the big rooms, and that's pretty classic for us. And for you, that's not necessarily something that one might, or even you might think you would like to do, want to do, but that's has been a huge part of your career and your work, teaching, standing in front of large groups of people, public speaking, and you are very good at it. I have heard you. So how did you overcome that? I know that's not necessarily something that you wanted to be the star of the classroom or the auditorium. Or the stage.
Yeah.
The stage.
Drama in there. Yeah. No, I mean, again, right? I was definitely the kid who, at the front of in middle school or on the bima for a bar mitzvah, right? The paper was definitely shaking, and I'm sure my voice was shaky as well for those kinds of things. And I think it came to a head during grad school when I was teaching in front of the, when I was a, had discussion sections of 20 or so students. Like, I remember that first time I did it, I literally like sat in the front and had my kind of computer in front of me with like the slides and things like that, but like stayed in that spot and avoided eye contact and things like that. And, you know, over the course of that semester, learned like, oh yeah, I should probably be standing while speaking and moving around and those kinds of things. And yeah, same with the clinical piece. Like, I remember going through like very long lengths to avoid having like my first case assignment. Cause yeah, just felt like, who am I? I don't know what I'm doing. Like, these people are paying to be here, and, you know, just not having any of that confidence. And so, yeah, like, it took a while. I don't think it was until maybe my third or fourth year of grad school, I think it was actually my fourth year, where I was working at a VA setting, and I think I really gained my confidence in that setting, particularly because, like, you know, veterans by nature and the ones I was working with are a little bit more grumpy, rough around the edges, like no BS, things like that, don't want to talk about their feelings. And so I think, like, having that experience and having had like success with that group, it was like, okay, like, if I can, you know, connect and be in and you know, gain the trust of these people who are naturally distrustful of a civilian young kid who didn't have any of the experiences, doesn't know anything about Vietnam or whatever else, like, having had that opportunity to gain and earn that trust definitely made me feel like, okay, yeah, like, you know, if I, you know, plenty of other people who I don't have to go through that barrier with. And so, so I think having gained some of that confidence from there and from teaching, and yeah, I know you attended when you were an undergrad, one of the, I did a guest lecture in one of the Psych 111 full courses, which I think is like 300 people or so. Interestingly enough, I don't know if there's some kind of like threshold thing, but like once you're talking to 20 people, like the extra couple of hundred, honestly, like,
doesn't matter.
It plays the same in my own brain. Like there's just not the, you know, it doesn't register as more. It's like a group, right? It's just officially group capacity. And so whether it's 20 or 200, I'm speaking to a group and I do the same thing, right? Like, I don't have to do anything differently. And so I think from that vantage point, that kind of allowed continue to build that comfort and security with those things where, yeah, even though it was definitely a difficult ride, and if you had asked me way back when about doing some of those things, yeah, I definitely would not have assumed that I'd be up there in front of a large group or doing some of these things. But here we are.
So proud of you. Obviously, thanks. I am. But also for that, really, I am, because I think it's a good message for everyone. There might be something that you're fearful of or you don't connect with or feel that you're naturally good at, but like you are good at that. So don't write off things that might seem intimidating or not fitting for you, because you could shine in that way and be really good, you know, doing that as an educator for you, public speaking and giving lectures and talks. Get it. A few things. So you've let me know that on Google Scholar, your work has been cited 2,751 times because you're a braggart. I'm kidding. Obviously, this person next to me is quite modest, but that is the amount of citations. That's extremely impressive. Of course, you're meeting with patients. Of course, you're leading research. Of course, you're doing so many things. And your work, I feel like, is so grounded in impact. I mean, you're really impacting people in so many different ways and all these different channels. And I'm curious for you, where do you feel you're making the most impact? Is it the fact that your work has been cited so much? Or is it after a session where there was a breakthrough or something really positive happened? Like, when do you feel really good about what you're doing?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think with the research side of things, and I think, as I had mentioned earlier, the nice thing about having different pieces is the research process is just so prolonged between thinking of a study, writing a grant, submitting a grant, waiting for it to be reviewed, putting in a resubmission, waiting for it to be reviewed again, finally potentially being funded. Then you just start to roll it out. Like, it's like a 10-year process for any like individual project. So things take a really long time. And because of that, right, like it's very delayed gratification for any of those pieces, like to the point where it's almost, for me at least, like hard to celebrate once it happens. And a lot of academics I know will just celebrate the submission of a grant because it's like this clear timeline, takes a lot of work. You don't know what's going to happen afterward. And there's no like right moment afterward just because it's so spaced out over time where it's like you're celebrating your birthday like 9 months after it happened. Whereas with the clinical piece, right, you do get some of that immediate satisfaction. You do get some of that short-term sustainment of like, okay, I don't know with this project or with this paper, like who's actually reading it, what difference it's going to make. It's very abstract. It's very kind of out in the world. You don't really know what's happening. And so I think having the clinical piece is nice and grounding. And then the other aspect that I was going to say in terms of that impact, which is fairly new, or I'm just kind of entering that phase now of kind of mentoring others and providing that role for new researchers or clinical trainees and things like that, where, you know, them being familiar with some of that work, bringing some of their ideas, potentially working with them and helping them to identify what their line of research and program is going to look like. I think that that has been a nice kind of new thing in the last year or so as I'm kind of, you know, getting older or continuing to move along this trajectory, that that's been a nice added piece that brings a little bit more of that kind of tangible, okay, like this is benefiting somebody directly that I can see, and I can see their growth and I can see their improvement in these areas. So I think those components too make for it because, yeah, like I said, the research thing is very kind of abstract and diluted, and it's very hard to tell. Obviously, like the numbers that you mentioned come in, but it's hard to know what that really means in a practical sense.
I like that you found this new channel for impact that you weren't necessarily expecting or thinking of, and you know, that wouldn't be obvious to me. So I like that, and I like that there's more ways to have an impact in what you're doing as you continue to grow in your career.
Yeah, well, and again, I've never liked to work with like a blank canvas. I always thought that I always work better, right, rather than trying to create something new from scratch. It's more about how do you kind of bring different things together to either improve efficiency or make something work better or for more people or apply it in a new area. And so I could see, you know, having those opportunities to kind of work with other people's starting ideas and helping to develop them with them, they being the lead. But I think I find that I have more to bring to the table from that lens as opposed to, okay, let's just think of a, you know, blank canvas, new ideas, whatever. Like someone asked me like, oh, if you had unlimited like research funding to do whatever you wanted, like what would you, there's some people who know like exactly what they would want to do. And I'd be like, I have no idea, or I'm gonna have to think about that. Because again, I think just my mind works better with kind of those starting points. And then how do you fit some of those different pieces together to make something new?
It's funny, because the next thing I wanted to ask you was what you're most looking forward to, like what lies ahead. But I guess based on what you just said, it might be hard to know because it'll depend on what happens in the in-between.
Yeah, no, I think, and that's part of, you know, with that whole process we were describing earlier in terms of not looking more than a couple years ahead, not having any predefined notion, right? Like that's one of those aspects in science or in research, right? Like you don't necessarily want to be overly committed to what you think that outcome is going to be. You want to approach it with that experimental mindset. Obviously you have a hypothesis, you have a sense of why you believe something might turn out a particular way, but you want to be open to be wrong. Like it's important to be open to being wrong and shifting gears if what you expected to find is different, right? So many of our findings, key findings in history, right? Like either came from a study that was designed to look at something else, or kind of went totally contrary to what we might have been thinking. And so I think having that mindset and applying it back to even just the career level aspiration things, having that experimental mindset. This is how I think things are going to go, but I'm leaving myself open to potentially being wrong and being able to, you know, accommodate this new information as it arises at a different phase.
Would you say that those would be your words of wisdom to give to someone who doesn't know what to do with their life?
Yes, go for it. Yeah, no, I think with people who are trying to find things, one of the big things that we talk a lot about in therapy for various things is really just trying to center on values, right? We can be very, you know, as a society in particular, like very goal-oriented, and goals are great. But once you hit a goal, right, it's what's the next goal, what's the next goal, what's the next goal, what's the next goal? And sometimes people keep moving goalpost and literal goalpost and find themselves unsatisfied, or they don't know what to do once they have everything that they wanted or thought that they wanted, and they're missing that fulfillment. And so values, in contrast to goals, values are directional, right? So as long as you're doing things along that direction of what your value is, something that can't be a check mark, right? So, you know, curiosity and creativity, right? Like, you can't check a box and be like, okay, I've accomplished creativity, or I've accomplished connection with others, or I've accomplished kindness, right? These are ongoing, continuous things that we're constantly striving for. Now, you can set goals that go along the way that help move you towards those values, but as long as the focus is on that values direction, then you'll end up being in a good place, because it's not necessarily about achieving those goals, it's about moving in that value direction. So whatever it is that you're looking for, consider what those values are, what's important to you, and finding ways to build that in. And whether that doesn't have to be in your job, right? Like, that can be to help offset, right? If you're in a job that maybe isn't particularly values-based, with the other time that you have, can you devote those things to those areas that do drive that sense of value?
I love it. I love that. I think that's in my top five favorite pieces of advice I've heard from guests. And I think that's something.
Who are the other four?
I don't know. But I really, really like that. And I've never heard anything like that before. I know you've coached me with that kind of, what's the word? Like, Teresa, like that approach before. You haven't coached me. Let's just relax on that. But you know what I mean.
I was just impressed by the Hebrew throwing.
The nice. Tfisa. Adam, it's been 45 minutes. How does it feel having been interviewed on your number one podcast?
Exactly as I thought it would be.
No surprises?
I don't think so. We'll see afterwards.
When we listen?
I don't know if I'm going to listen. We'll see.
Are you serious right now?
This might be the one episode I don't listen to.
Are you kidding? Why? All right.
I hate the sound of my voice.
Oh my God. Well.
It's not good. Maybe on the 1.5, it'll sound different enough where I can tolerate it. So we'll see.
Well, this is beyond frustrating, but I'm very happy to have you on the show. Thank you for everything you do for the world and for many, many people and for me and your family and friends. And I can't wait to, why are you making a face at me? I'm appreciative of the work you do. You do very, very important work, and I value it greatly, and so do many people. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, everyone. I told you Adam was amazing. This was such a fun conversation. I'm so glad we got to do it in person. Some of my personal highlights. When Adam said that in science and research, you don't want to be overly committed to the outcome. You want to approach it with this experimental mindset. And he shared that so many key findings in history came from a study that was designed to look at something else or went contrary to what we may have been thinking. So he thinks we should apply this kind of mindset when we look at career aspirations to accommodate the new information as it arises and, you know, have that kind of attitude that things may be a bit different than we initially thought and be open to it. I also love what Adam says about centering on values. As a society, we're really goal-oriented, and once we hit the goal, we're already looking for the next thing, and this can make many of us feel unsatisfied, not know what we should do next, we're not feeling very fulfilled. And Adam said that values are directional. As long as we do things along the direction of the value, whether is it being creative, is it being a connector, bringing people together, this approach will be more fulfilling and productive and help get us closer to where we want to be. It was a big treat talking to my big brother. There are many more family members I want to introduce you to soon, so stay tuned, and thank you so much.